Being at an airport is never really an enjoyable venture. It doesn't matter if you're flying first class to the most beautiful, serene locales. The journey of being at the airport itself, getting to departures, maneuvering your way through the hordes to just check your bag, stripping down to go through security, juggling your random belongings without a belt or shoes, getting to your gate to find you've been moved to another gate, seemingly miles away. Crowded holiday airports not only can raise your blood pressure, but can make you doubt your faith in your fellow man, while deserted late-night red-eye flights can leave you feeling hollow, lonely, just around the corner from that existential crisis. But it's not the airport's fault. I mean, they are, after all, transitory places. You are going there with the sole intent of leaving. That's the point of an airport. It gets you to the next part of your journey on time, with all your belongings intact, hopefully. You and hundreds of others all in the same place, racing the clock to catch your flight so you can be on your way. So while that hopefully brief visit to the airport may be draining, frustrating, maybe sometimes seemingly soul-crushing, it's not as if the airport itself has an agenda. The airport, the building with all of its terminals, escalators, and security lines itself isn't sinister or evil. Right? Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. These next couple of episodes, we take a good long look at Denver International Airport, the home of some outrageous conspiracy theories ranging all the way from a post-apocalyptic future of total domination by a one-world government all the way to the other extreme with prophecies about how humanity will be saved by embracing environmental consciousness and other points of interest in between. How could one airport become host to all these stories, and how did they all take flight? What possesses people to believe that hiding in plain sight, Denver International Airport is the last stronghold of a new world order? We'll look at the history of the airport's construction, its strange and seemingly dangerous art collection, including the true story of how one piece killed its creator. And we'll talk about the ambitious plans that Colorado had for this airport, and how that aspiration became a cautionary tale that's just as weird as any conspiracy theory out there. When construction started on Denver International Airport, it really was in the middle of nowhere. Stapleton, the airport that was replaced by DIA, was centrally located to Denver, only 3 miles from downtown. The older, smaller airport had been in place since 1929 and served travelers' needs well, that is, until the event of airline deregulation. Prior to 1978, the federal government regulated airlines. It was pretty much required for airlines to first seek regulatory approval for pretty much everything. Control over fares, routes, and even the creation of new airlines was regulated. When this was lifted, the commercial airline industry became a free market, leading to a boom in the number of flights, lower fares, even the creation of new airlines. More Americans could fly more often and for a lot less money. But with this boom came some big trade-offs. More new airlines were entering the market, and this meant more competition overall. More new airlines, more routes, cheaper flights meant older airports had to accommodate for this new complexity and new growth. They had to build out more gate space, more counter space, and they had to have the ability to ramp up and operate more airport terminals. Added to this newness was also the established airlines' attempts to get as many new routes as possible into their systems as well. Growth is great for airports' long-term expansion plans, but deregulation turned into a short-term disaster in the simple terms of congestion problems. There just wasn't enough airports to go around. This new space shortage led way to airports adopting what is now commonly called a hub-and-spoke strategy, The idea is there is a single hub airport for one airlines. It brings in a lot of flights into the single airport or the hub 3 or 4 times a day and then interchanges these same passengers out into other flights during a brief layover period. This layover period and then the subsequent flights back out are called spokes. It's generally how we fly today. But at the time, you can imagine the kind of musical chairs played by the airline industries to grab the best, most centrally located airports to designate as their own hub. It had to be conveniently in the middle of the country, big enough to shuffle passengers in and out of quickly, and big enough to not just accommodate their existing fleet, but also new growth. Denver was perfectly located as a pit stop and a plane change for people flying across country. Post-deregulation, Stapleton climbed to be the 6th busiest airport in the U.S., mostly because of connecting flyers. At least half of Denver's traffic was merely just passing through. But ultimately, deregulation sounded the death knell for Stapleton. The old Denver airport was reliable, functional. Basically, there was nothing really wrong with it. But Colorado state officials recognized that deregulation represented opportunities for their state. Not just opportunities, but revenue. And no one saw this potential more clearly than Federico Peña, Denver's mayor elected to office in 1983. Peña recalls the state of Denver when he started office.
A year into my administration, we fell into a major recession. Our unemployment rate was 2 points above the national average. We had a 30% office vacancy rate in downtown Denver. The state of Colorado actually had a net loss of population, which had never happened before. Every sector of the economy imploded.
And this is true. Much of the city's economy had gone bust with the oil industry. And the air travel industry seemed to be a substitute worth pursuing. Peña said that shrinking city revenue persuaded local politicians that they needed to act.
We had to invest. We had Republicans, Democrats, and Independents coming together to get the airport approved, financed, and built. We understood we had to diversify from what for the past 90 years was referred to as a boom and bust economy.
Galvanized by Peña, Colorado leaders painted Stapleton as not just old, but completely antiquated. All but one runway had to be shut down in the snow and bad weather. The only expansion possible was on to the poisonous Rocky Mountain Arsenal. It was too close to dense urban population, and there were numerous noise complaints. But maybe worst of all was the idea that if they did not act, Denver would lose out for good. Salt Lake City's Mayor Palmer DePaulis said the long-haul flyers could make connections at his city's airport instead, saying, "We'd like to fill that gap if Denver doesn't take the lead and build a new airport." So even though the FAA approved building more runways on portions that were not polluted, and the noise problem was less than other major airports, even though Stapleton was making a profit of $50 to $80 million a year, the plans for the brand new airport were approved by Denver voters by 65% in 1989. And Denver International Airport would be nothing short of an epic achievement. It just needed to be built. And here is where the story of the shiny new airport starts to get just a little bit darker. Denver International Airport would become 7 times larger than the size of Stapleton. This fact really doesn't put into context its true size. DIA and the land it inhabits is huge. It's twice the size of Manhattan. It would become the 2nd largest public works project in the world, 2nd only to the channel linking England to France. And by land area, it is the largest U.S. airport and the 3rd largest in the world. The land the airport sits on is that big. But that's nothing when you learn that 110 million cubic yards of earth were moved during the building of the project. This is equivalent to one-third the amount of earth moved in building the Panama Canal. After voters approved the plans in 1986, the real work started with the architectural plans. Denver hired architect August Perez of New Orleans, a personal friend of Mayor Peña's. He envisioned the new airport as a 19th-century-style train station with huge riveted beams and massive skylights. The Fenders Braeburn firm was hired to be the production architects for the project. Their job was to make Perez's design into more of a reality, to take the design and the budget and make blueprints and then to oversee the construction. Fenders Braeburn also had the unenviable responsibility to determine if the Perez design could be achieved on budget and within the time constraint. Perez's 19th century train station overshot the budget by $54 million and could not possibly be achieved in the time needed. So now, even before a single drop of cement is poured, the city of Denver had to reconsider the whole concept.
We got this pile of drawings that were basically useless. On top of that, they hadn't worked out anything engineering-wise, said Jim Bradburn.
The city bought out Perez for $6 million, and Bradburn was asked to come up with a design. The main terminal, what is now known as Jepson Terminal, was the main architectural focal point. It called for a central opening area requiring a 150-foot span.
This needs to be cabled, thought Bradburn. To get across this span the fastest and cheapest way, solving two problems, budget and time, is through cables. I went out for lunch and drew up this simple tent-like structure and said, it needs to be like this. I pictured an encampment of Native Americans on a bluff, he said, while speaking of his visions of white teepees raising out of the grasslands. I wanted our original architecture to acknowledge the original inhabitants' architecture and be sympathetic to the regional environment.
What is now considered iconic imagery of Denver International Airport at the time was a big leap of faith and construction, and it had really not been done before. Bradburn found the number one fabric tensile membrane structural engineer in the world, Horst Berger. The fabric used on Jepson Terminal is a woven fiberglass. It's coated with Teflon. There are two layers of fabric, the lower layer, which is seen upon entering the terminal, and the outer layer, which is structural, and you can see upon approaching the terminal. It is cleaned periodically using just soap and water, and is estimated to have a 50-year-plus lifespan, according to Bradburn. This new design was in budget and would work with the timing. It was immediately received with a stamp of approval. Mayor Peña, though, was concerned that the concept of comparing it to the Native American teepees may be considered offensive, so it was settled. The official line was that the structure was to represent the mountain peaks of the Rockies. Unfortunately, the ingenuity of Bradburn's Teflon Peaks would be the last lucky save Denver International Airport would have during its construction. Beginning its construction in September of 1989, the first cost estimates reported by the city of Denver were at about $2.08 billion. This was reported in May of 1990 in an official statement prepared to promote the sale of airport revenue bonds. But Denver International Airport didn't board its first passenger until February 1995, four delays and six long years later. And when it did actually open, the real construction costs totaled to over $3 billion. That's close to $1 billion over the original estimate. So what happened that threw construction so far off schedule? What cost so much money that made the money that Denver paid out to Perez for his unusable drawings look like a minor rounding error? We'll get to this story. But first, let's talk about the one thing in particular that helps make DIA famous today. Located just outside the main entrance to Denver International Airport, in the median of Peña Boulevard, stands one of the first pieces of art especially commissioned for the airport, Blue Mustang, as it is formerly known, by the artist Luis Jimenez. And like the airport itself, Blue Mustang is imposing, to say the least. Standing at a towering 32 feet tall, Blue Mustang is, well, exactly that. It's an electric blue horse reared up on its hind legs with glowing neon red eyes. With the absence of anything even close to the statue, both in size and in proximity, it's difficult to describe this statue and truly do it justice. It actually is somewhat terrifying. Jimenez explained his thinking in an interview in 1996.
The spaces for art at Denver had already been planned out, so it didn't seem that interesting. They weren't where I would have put them. They weren't focal points, so I decided to go to the committee and tell them, look, I think what we really need is something going on outside. I thought it would be nice to have something to identify the site out of the knoll, an important focal point as you're entering or leaving the airport. I said, you've got a natural site here. What if we call it Mustang Overlook for the wild Mustangs that used to be out here and have a Mustang sculpture with eyes that light up?
Sure, its eyes light up. From the start, airport officials and the artist had agreed to install Mustang in front of the terminal, looking at Long's Peak. It was even going to be accessible to the public, with a parking area around it so people could view the statue closer up. But those plans were canceled over security issues and the fact that the site was actually very close to a runway. Louise wanted Blue Mustang to pay tribute to Denver's historic relation with the horse. It would frame downtown Denver, Pikes Peak in the mountains. Blue Mustang would signify a magnificent accomplishment. Completing a monumental piece at a public venue meant that the artist would definitely leave his mark on the art world. Jimenez was born in 1940 in El Paso, Texas. His grandmother and grandfather were both neon sign makers who came to America from Mexico in 1924. Jimenez received a fine art degree from the University of Texas at Austin in 1964 and found inspiration in the bright colors of his family's neon signs and of his life in the Southwest.
I decided that if my images were going to be taken from popular culture, I wanted a material that didn't carry the cultural baggage of marble or bronze.
The installation would signify a magnificent accomplishment for Jimenez. Again, completing a monumental piece at such a public venue meant that he would leave his mark in the public art scene, a dream that he had had for decades.
I used to tell people that my work was totally dictated by the site, but now I realize it's really not. I have a personal agenda, certain images that I want to work with. When I go to work somewhere, I'm sort of dovetailing my personal agenda with the character of the place and the site and trying to make all this work together.
In a later 1999 interview for Art Lies magazine, Jimenez talked about such a tremendous commission, stating he was experiencing almost burnout from the DIA project.
We all have burnout. And I have burnout, especially on these large pieces. I have a piece that I haven't delivered for Denver. I keep asking myself why it's taking so long to do it.
Jimenez's older age and blindness in his left eye were a primary concern.
I'm not as strong as I used to be, and I don't have the energy to go 3 days in a row without sleep like I used to.
After Jimenez missed completion deadlines, the city of Denver filed a lawsuit against him. For $165,000 it had paid up front for the statue. But the city agreed to drop the suit if the sculpture was finished by the end of the year, but that was not to be. In 2006, while completing the Mustang, an unsecured piece of a 9,000-pound sculpture fell on Jimenez, killing him. He was by himself in his studio, rushing to finish the nearly completed sculpture, and was reportedly using a rope to hoist a section of the sculpture into place so it could be welded. The hoist broke, and the piece fell on the 66-year-old, pinning him to the ground and slicing an artery in his leg. Jimenez died on his studio floor. In 2007, the almost finished Mustang finally went from the Jimenez studio in California for pre-installation engineering in Colorado. By now, the value had doubled and then tripled to be closer to $2 million. Appraised by Jeffrey Bergen of the ACA Gallery in New York, he says, the figure accounts for the fact that there are only a handful of monumental works left by Jimenez, and this is the largest of the group. And so, the Blue Mustang was installed 2 years after Jimenez's death. The city ended up paying $650,000, more than double what it had originally intended. News of Jimenez's death spread quickly, and memorial services were held across the country to honor him. On February 11, 2008, Blue Mustang was installed along Peña Boulevard in a private ceremony where art collectors, journalists, politicians, and Jimenez's family gathered to celebrate the monument. A plaque at the base of the statue reads,
"Completed and installed posthumously by his family and studio staff."
Jimenez's wife and two of his sons had finished the piece with the help of others. But not everyone thought the statue should be completed because it would never match the artist's true intentions. A 1997 lithography of the Mustang by Jimenez shows the horse rising up from a ground covered with historical artifacts, what appears to be an animal skull, arrowheads, a spur, among other objects, contexts that are missing from the installation at DIA. There's no location to be able to get intimate with the work. Artist Lawrence Argent, who created the sculptures at the Colorado Convention Center, told the New York Times in 2009, "It's a vista from afar, and to many, it's a frightening vista from afar." Many did praise the new statue as Luis Jimenez's crowning achievement. Manager of Aviation Kim Daly said,
"It is a sculpture of action and power which symbolizes where we are headed and what we love about Denver and the West. Freedom, a sense of wilderness, natural beauty, and most of all, determination."
Michael Hancock, then president of Denver City Council, quite aptly prophesized,
"It will forever incite dialogue."
Oh, and it has. Unwelcome and unappreciated by many Denver residents and art critics, Blue Mustang immediately took some serious backlash. People said it looked apocalyptic, devilish. Coupled with the untimely death of the artist, Blue Mustang took on the identity of a cursed object and was given the moniker of Blucifer. Detractors have said that the statue looks possessed, but it's horrible, disturbing. It's been called a demon horse and the blue stallion of death. It's safe to say that not everyone liked the giant blue horse. And here is one of my favorites.
A statue of a giant male horse, electric-eyed, cobalt blue, and anatomically correct, was installed in February 2008 on the railway approach to the terminal, and it is freaking more than a few people out. The Denver Post.
In early 2009, local developer Rachel Holton created a now-defunct Facebook page called DIA's Heinous Blue Mustang Has Got to Go. This site quickly attracted thousands of members, as well as a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal and other major pieces in the New York Times. But no matter how artistically people made their requests, Mustang could not go anywhere, not at least for another 4 years. City policy mandates that public art pieces had to be in place for 5 years before the city would even consider moving them.
DIA, Art and Culture Program, Public Art Policy Guide, dated October 1, 2012. On rare occasions, unusual circumstances warrant the removal, relocation, or disposal of a work of art from the city's collection. The Denver Commission on Cultural Affairs follows established procedures for deaccession and relocation to ensure that the integrity of public art, artists, and the public is respected. Generally, artwork will not be removed from the public display sooner than 5 years after its installation. A request for deaccession or relocation involves careful consideration of public option, professional judgment, and legal advice.
So, 5 years later, did Denver decide to tear Blucifer down? In the fall of 2011, the airport conducted a public art survey to prepare for their next round of acquisitions. From these results, they admit that they are not hearing many calls to deacquisition the piece. There continues to be a discussion, one airport official says, noting that about 50% love the piece and about 50% loathe it. But the survey also determined that Mustang is the best-known piece of art at DIA. It has become a cultural touchstone, and not just in Colorado, but nationally. DIA Director of Arts and Public Events commented on the public art at DIA, specifically the Mustang.
We have about 40 pieces in the permanent collection out here, and I think he's one of the most beloved pieces, especially by the airport.
Patty Ortiz continues.
I always love this work, and I think a lot of times it can be misunderstood because it's kind of fierce in a way, and not easy to look at, but it's not meant to be easy. It's supposed to challenge and make them think.
One director of arts and public events said, "Here's my thing. Most of the people who don't like the Blue Mustang still value public art. And now a whole group have emerged who may think it's a badass Blue Mustang, but it's our badass Blue Mustang." So, in the span of 5 short years, Jimenez's statue has gone from cursed to beloved, badass even, a symbol of Denver. Mustang has done its job as a piece of public art. Luis Jimenez saw something much greater than just a blue Mustang. There is a myth from the San Luis Valley dwellers of southern Colorado, a story about a Mustang.
Who could run even faster than the wind? Who would gather the herd from the plains and lead them to the sweetest grass and water of a blue Mustang whose eyes glowed red? He could run so fast, some say he could fly.
So is the identity that Jimenez's Blue Mustang is communicating for Denver International Airport the hopeful myth, or is it a memento mori for a deceased sculptor whose vision became the instrument of his own death? Is Denver International Airport beloved or demonic? Or does it somehow get to be both? Are we being led to the sweet grass and water, or are we just part of the herd? Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. On our next episode, we'll look at some of the conspiracies that have somehow been born from the airport and try to get to the bottom of them with a couple of guests. John Wenzel, Denver Post reporter, who is the definitive expert on all things DIA, and author and professor Joseph Uzinski, who wrote the book American Conspiracy Theories. So, until then, safe travels, and remember, keep listening, won't you?